A thing that looks like a police box standing in a junkyard. It can move anywhere.
Haven, concentrate on Sin. Give priority to the detectors and the navigation systems.
There is a corridor. And the corridor is time. It surrounds all things.
On display, I eventually had to go down to the cellar.
That's the display department.
With a torch.
The lights are probably gone.
So had the stairs.
Yours is number 6.
I am not a number. I am a person.
Welcome to British Invaders, episode 86. This is the podcast all about British science fiction television, and today we are talking about The Day After Tomorrow. This is Brian from Canada.
And this is Eamon from England. Hello. Yes, The Day After Tomorrow, where we find out what happens when Gerry Anderson sends two families on a voyage to explore the very limits of the universe.
And in fact, not only the limits of the universe, but the limits of physics, because this was a show that dealt with Einsteinian physics and was meant to be an adventure show for kids with lots of space travel in it, but was also definitely intended to teach a little bit about Einsteinian physics, and it has lots of really interesting examples of different things that can happen traveling, approaching the speed of light, and so on. This is, of course, not to be confused with the more recent movie, The Day After Tomorrow. This was the 1975 British television show that was also called Into Infinity.
Yeah, that's right. A 50-minute live-action production from Anderson and his team, of course, perhaps better known for his puppet or super marionation shows, but this is one of his live-action shows, as you say, Brian, from 1975, produced by Anderson for NBC in America, but shown over here on BBC as well. And this interesting mix of science fiction and hard science fact, as you say, trying to bring across some of the concepts of Einsteinian physics. So it's quite an interesting show to talk about.
Yes, absolutely. So the setup for this was about a spaceship called the Altares that had a brand new type of engine on it called the photon drive, which taps into the atomic power of the photon and allows speeds approaching the speed of light. So all of these different relativistic effects and things can start to come into play. And the series starts with the crew of this spaceship going to an orbital space station Delta, in order to board the Altares and go on this extended voyage.
And the voyage is planned to take them to Alpha Centauri, the star which is about 4 light years away from us. And because, as you say, they're going to be experiencing speeds approaching the speed of light, they're going to run into lots of relativistic effects, including time dilation. And so obviously, they decide, rather than leaving families separated by this, that they would send families on board. So they choose 2 families to crew the Altares, a family called the Bowens and another group called the Masters, who are going to make up the crew. And that's who we see right at the start on Space Station Delta, getting ready to set off on this rather fantastic voyage.
And of course, it conveniently allows there to be a couple of children involved, which lets them market it a little bit differently because of that.
Yes, it's a way in for the children who were supposed to be the main audience for this show. And it's sort of, I suppose, it's a convenient device for that. So we should talk about the crew of this ship. We've mentioned the 2 families. We start with the captain, Captain Harry Masters. He was played by a quite recognisable actor at the time, Nick Tate, who would crop up in another Gerry Anderson show, Space 1999, as one of the main Eagle pilots in that show. And he's the main pilot and leader of the Altares, sort of very much, I suppose, the hero role, the clean-cut leading man. He's more recently cropped up on television in an episode of Lost, playing an Australian farmer. You may recognise him from there. But here he is, you know, youthful and full of vigour, and attacking the lead role.
And we also had his daughter, Jane Masters, played by Catherine Levy, who British Invaders listeners may remember from Children of the Stones. She was the young girl in Children of the Stones, and even before that, she was in this show, The Day After Tomorrow. And she was not only Harry Masters' daughter, she was also his co-pilot. They had the children sort of trained and doing responsible jobs in this. So Harry Masters was the captain, and he was essentially the pilot as well. And his daughter was his co-pilot. And they did some nice relationship things there as well. Now, going into the second family, we had Dr. Tom Bowen, played by Brian Blessed, who is very well known from British TV and many films. And he was the lead navigator and scientist. So he was almost like a second captain type character.
And we should perhaps say that this is a very calm Brian Blessed. We'll talk about that a bit more as we go along, but he's perhaps more known for his slightly over-the-top performances. Here, he's quite nicely restrained, isn't he, Brian?
Yes, not nearly as shouty. I don't think he shouts once in this.
No, he's not the usual loud and shouty Brian Blessed.
But his understated performance worked quite well, though.
Yeah, it's a different performance from him, from what we're used to. His wife, Dr. Anna Bowen, was played by Joanna Dunham, who was also another Space 1999 actor. And she takes on the role of the chief medical officer on board the Altari. So she's looking after the health of the two families as they undergo this remarkable voyage at these quite incredible speeds. And then rounding out the group is their son, David Bowen, played by a young actor called Martin Lev, perhaps best known for his role as Dandy Dan in the movie Bugsy Malone. And he's the son, and he's obviously, as you say, the children take on important roles on board the ship, and he is assistant navigator to his father. And we see him a lot working things out and puzzling over his instruments, and also, rather charmingly, his slide rule on board the Altaris.
Yes, there are definitely some slide rules in play in here in addition to their computers, which is a little interesting.
I miss slide rules. I think we should see them more often in our movies.
Yes, well, they had them in the original Star Trek, and they have them in this too.
Yep.
There was a narration as well for the opening and closing of this story, this episode, and that was done by Ed Bishop, who Gerry Anderson had worked with on Captain Scarlet and also quite notably on UFO. Ed Bishop played the main character in UFO, and he was one of these actors who made a career of being an American with an American accent in the UK. So he showed up here giving an American-accented narration.
And he cropped up when we talked about Threads, because he provided the voice on the radio of the American president in that as well. So Ed Bishop making his third appearance in British Invaders now.
Yes, and he showed up in, I believe, James Bond films once or twice. He showed up in a variety of things.
Yeah.
There's a big blue planet coming up to us now. It's Pluto, and it isn't really blue. We're travelling so fast that the light waves get squashed up to the short end of the spectrum, so it only looks blue. As it recedes, you'll see it turn red. It's called the Doppler shift. Navigators, you think you know it all? Just enough to get us where we're going.
So getting into our production notes here, we had mentioned Space 1999 already a couple of times. Space 1999 was a live-action show by Gerry Anderson, very popular. And the reason there are so many connections to it is that this was being done roughly at the same time as Space 1999. During the production, near the end of the first season of Space 1999, Gerry Anderson was approached by George Heinemann, the vice president of the NBC television network in the U.S. And Heinemann wanted a series of one-hour specials that could explain some of this modern physics and Einsteinian physics to younger viewers and be wrapped up in an action type, you know, action adventure type show that would have, you know, some space travel and these kinds of things. So it was a natural to go to Gerry Anderson, who had done that before and was in the midst of doing it with Space 1999.
So having been approached, Anderson then sort of turned again to somebody from the crew of Space 1999. He went to his script editor, Johnny Byrne, and between them they came up with this idea for the pilot show, which they thought at the time obviously would be the basis of a longer-running show. And that became The Day After Tomorrow.
It was definitely set up so it could be ongoing and have a series of specials there. Also worth noting, Johnny Byrne went on to write a number of Doctor Who serials, notably The Keeper of Kraken near the end of the Tom Baker run. So it was interesting to see him popping up a little bit earlier on this.
Right. And do we know if the rest of the serials were going to be a continuation of this story, or were they going to be separate standalone stories? I wasn't quite sure as we were looking through the production stuff, Brian.
There isn't a lot of information about that. My understanding is that it would have been the same crew on the same spaceship, and they would be sort of having different adventures each time, and each adventure would be set up to explain some different things with different elements of physics.
All right. The continuing adventures of the starship Altaris and the Captain Masters. Right.
I think so.
Okay. So with Johnny Byrne doing the script to Anderson, we then have the director and a very famous British director called Charles Crichton, who had also worked on Space 1999, not surprisingly, but perhaps best known over here for being the director of many of the Ealing comedies and later on directing a very famous movie indeed, A Fish Called Wanda, which won many awards, many of them for the director himself. So quite a well-known British film and television director, Charles Crichton.
Yes, absolutely. And they filmed at Pinewood Studios. They did 10 days of live-action shooting, followed by 6 weeks of special effects work. So there was a lot of stuff being done on this, which was nice. I think that paid off quite well in the look of it and how the thing worked. They reused some models from Space 1999. In particular, the Space Station Delta was a ship from the first season of Space 1999 that had been redressed and changed up a little bit to serve on The Day After Tomorrow. And some of the props and models would also go on to be used in the second series of Space 1999, which went into production right after they finished work on The Day After Tomorrow.
So 6 weeks of special effects and models work. I think it shows us that Gerry Anderson's productions, as we would expect, very heavy on the model work and the special effects that go with them. I think it gives us some idea of the proportion of the work they would have to do for this show and other shows like Space 1999 and UFO, which we've discussed before.
I think Gerry Anderson was very exacting with that, and probably one of the reasons that his model work looked so good was that they put in so much effort and spent so much time to get it right.
Mm. Okay. Normally when we're talking about a Gerry Anderson production, we're talking about his regular composer, Barry Gray, and I always like the Barry Gray music for all the Gerry Anderson shows, but Gray wasn't available this time, so we have Derek Wadsworth producing some very suitably dramatic music to accompany this this one-off film. And all in all, the production cost £125,000. And it's always difficult to get a hold of whether that's a lot of money, but it seems like quite a big budget for a 1975 show, Brian.
Yes, certainly for a one-off 50-minute show, that does seem like quite a bit.
Yeah.
It was first broadcast on NBC in December 1975, and it was shown on the BBC in December 1976, by the time it was broadcast in the UK, it was clear that they were not going to make any more episodes of this. And the BBC decided that they didn't want to have two titles. They didn't want to have The Day After Tomorrow Into Infinity, because the original version, it was set up so The Day After Tomorrow was the title of the series, and the episode title was Into Infinity. So the BBC edited things a little bit, so the only title was Into Infinity, and it wasn't called The Day After Tomorrow at all. I think it was easier to take the title The Day After Tomorrow out. So in the US, in the original broadcast, it was known as The Day After Tomorrow, with the episode being called Into Infinity. And in the UK, the whole thing was just called Into Infinity.
Right. So that was 76. It was broadcast on the BBC. And then I think they repeated it again in 1977. But since then, it has disappeared from our screens, hasn't been seen since, which we'll go on to talk about ways that you can watch it when we get to our next episode. But this is a bit of a sort of like a lost Gerry Anderson show from the mid-70s. And of course, as you say, the lost pilot for a longer series that never happened. And we can only speculate what the other episodes would have been called and what they would have been about.
That's right. Yeah, this is one of these things that sort of disappeared a little bit. One thing that is worth noting, this has been referred to as Gerry Anderson's only work for the BBC, which is true. I believe it's the only thing that Gerry Anderson produced that had its first British broadcast on the BBC. Almost all of his work was with ITV. But there was, as far as I know, no direct collaboration with the BBC. It was all with NBC for the American broadcast. And the BBC just bought the rights to broadcast it a couple of times once it was a finished production.
Right. So it's also really, I guess, it's an American production, but it's a mainly British crew, obviously, producing it. And then it was shown on the BBC. So we're going to include it in British Invaders under that, under those reasons.
Yeah, it walks that edge. It was like a British production that was an American commission or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
Space Station Delta, the jump-off point for humanity's first momentous journey to the stars. The lightship Altares, the first of its kind to harness the limitless power of the photon, particles of light which can boost the ship to 186,000 miles per second, the speed of light. This could create the effects predicted by Einstein's theory of relativity, effects that could shrink the very fabric of space, distort time, and perhaps alter the structure of the universe as we understand it. Effects which no man has yet experienced. And you will share it. The crew are arriving from Earth. They will be the first to fulfill man's dream to break out into deep space. To leave the world we call Earth. A tiny planet circling a small, cool star we call the Sun. One of some 200 billion suns in our galaxy. The Milky Way, which we call the stars, and our galaxy, just one among billions strewn throughout the infinity of space, the universe. A universe not only stranger than we imagine, but stranger than we can imagine.
So I think that concludes things for the first half of our discussion on The Day After Tomorrow, Into Infinity. Next time, we will look into some of the science of The Day After Tomorrow. There is certainly a lot of it, and it's certainly very interesting.
We'll talk a bit more about the first voyage of the spaceship Altares. We'll get on to talk a bit more about Gerry Anderson himself, and of course, get to our reviews and recommendations about The Day After Tomorrow.
Yes, we have lots of interesting little things to talk about here, because this is an interesting and very unusual little show.
Okay.
You can reach us at BritishInvaders@gmail.com, and you can find us at www.BritishInvaders.com. We have a Facebook group, so if you go to Facebook and search for British Invaders, you can find us there. So thank you for listening, and this is Brian from Canada, signing off.
Yes, thank you very much. Please come back next time for part two. Until then, this is Eamon in England saying goodbye.